Board here yesterday afternoon, we decided to break the material into two, and I did half of it yesterday afternoon, now I'm going to do the other half today. So yesterday we did all the introductory and then got through Revelation chapter 6. So now I'm starting with chapter 7. We are in the midst of the central section of the three judgment septets, the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls, chapter 6 to 16. Now, they are made up not just of these three sets of judgments, but also three interludes that break into these judgments. And chapter 7 is the first of them. Two of the interludes come between the sixth and the seventh seal, and also the sixth and the seventh trumpet. Then the third interlude comes between the seventh trumpet and the bowls. The purpose of the interludes is to tell us the part of the people of God in these events. All of the judgments affect only the earth dwellers. The earth dwellers are the people who are of this world who have rejected God and are persecuting his people. And they're called earth dwellers in the book, those who inhabit the earth. The saints, then, are not really part of the action in the judgment passages. Like Egypt, Israel was never touched by the plagues. The saints are not touched by these judgments. So the place of the saints is found in the interludes. And we see the first of these in chapter 7, which is made up of two parts. And the first part is the sealing of the 144,000. Now I've got to watch how long we take with all these things, because I could very easily end up not having time for my theology, because I took too much time with the text. So let me keep my watch open here. Basically, the debate, of course, is very simple. Is the 144,000 literal, and does it refer to Israel? Or is the 144,000 symbolic, and does it refer to the church? In a very real sense, it breaks down on the basis of prior positions you take. And almost always, all dispensational pre-tribs take this literally of Israel. And the Left Behind series has these as a literal number of 144,000 for the witnesses during that tribulation period. Numbers in the book of Revelation are highly symbolic at the start. And all I can do is give you my arguments for why I believe that this is indeed the church and 144,000 is symbolic. First of all, 10 of the tribes disappeared forever with the Assyrian and Babylonian captivities. And there's no likelihood that they're ever going to resurface as if somehow they managed to come through. You know, Armstrongism thought that it was Britain who were the last 10 tribes, which is rather foolish. And the Mormons even thought that the 10 lost tribes may be, of course, that group that was Joseph Smith visited, you know, in Central America and so on. But actually, the 10 tribes have pretty much disappeared. And so it's unlikely this is meant literally, I think. I mean, actually, you know, these 10 tribes are going to appear, then that there's going to be 12,000 each of them from each of the tribes. So those two things make me believe that the best option is that that this deals with the new Israel, the fulfillment of the prophecies of the Old Testament, which the church was, as the new Israel, the true circumcision, and so on. So my understanding of this, at least, is that the whole people of God, all the saints, are being sealed. This, in a sense, is a flashback before this period begins, before the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls. God's people are sealed, and what that means is, coming out of Ezekiel, we have the mark of God on our foreheads, and we belong to him. And that brings in all the imagery of slavery. We are his slaves. We are, and as such, though, we're a member of his family. We're under his protection. He is watching over us. And my other view is that this is the same group in the second half of chapter 7. You have a flashback before and then a flash forward afterwards, where you have the multitude in heaven rejoicing in God and singing the praises. And then you have a beautiful picture at the end of chapter 7 of the saints before the throne of God, serving him day and night. We become priests. Chapter 1 said that in Jesus, coming out of Exodus 19, we are kingdom and priests. Well, this is the priestly side. As you can see there in verse 15, we serve him day and night. Then he spreads his tent over us. We never hunger or thirst. And then that beautiful picture, which, again, the shepherd, notice, the lamb is their shepherd and leads them to springs of water. This is another reversal, a transformation. The lamb becomes a shepherd. And so much imagery of the Old Testament flows through here, from Ezekiel and from the Psalms. And just an unbelievably beautiful passage. But I really think what it is saying is two things. The saints are God's people, and the saints are guaranteed heaven. We will worship God. And so it's a picture out of all the tumult of what is ahead for us, on a basis of what is behind us. All right, chapter 8 then gets us back into the tumult on earth. And I've already mentioned the first 5 verses, the introduction, where you have the angel taking the prayers of the saints. And remember from yesterday, those are the prayers for vengeance from chapter 6, 9, and 11, the imprecatory prayers. And then the coal that's placed in the altar. And another thing, too, in the book of Revelation, there aren't 2 altars. There's been, it's interesting how much debate there's been in commentaries. Is the altar in this place or that place? Is it the incense altar, the altar for an offering? Well, I think there's now a kind of a coalition of ideas that I think rightly says the heavenly temple only has 1 altar that combines the burnt offering altar with the incense altar. And they're here. It's the incense altar, then the coal from the burnt altar is placed in the same censer. Each one actually had different censers. So the heavenly temple combines the altar aspect from the earthly temple. At any rate, the whole point is the trumpets are initiated by God responding to the prayers of the saints. And then we see them coming, and as I mentioned yesterday, the order of the trumpets and bowls is based upon, first of all, the Egyptian plagues. Secondly, it's the exact same order. It can be of the judgment on earth, then the oceans, then the inland waters, then the heavenly bodies. And each of these, again, is meant to be seen as a tensive symbol. We are to look at it as if it is happening and ask its power and not worry about what God's really going to do. Because he can do any of these if he wishes, but he's not telling us. He just wants us to feel as the Romans did. You know, each one of these is devastating. The first one, the hail and fire mixed with blood, I think is based upon the eruption of the Aegean Islands about 50 AD. And it was a huge eruption. It was then said at that time that the sky was dark for days and that the Sahara Desert was turned to blood because it was a red ash that came out rather than the normal black ash. And it turned the Sahara Desert red when it fell on it. And that fits the imagery of this, the hail and fire mixed with blood. Now, again, that's just background image. This will be one that's far worse because, worse, this is worldwide. A third, now notice it was a quarter of the seals. Now a third of all the trees are burned up and all the green grass. I can't take a lot of time with each one, of course, because we have about a half hour to get through all the rest of this book. But when you think about that, in terms of the forest fires that we see, you know, like in Colorado last summer, or in California, or in Florida, or if you've ever been to Yellowstone, every forest, one third of the Amazon, one third, you know, of the African forest and the Russian forest, and then here, firefighters would not be able to keep up. There would be no hope. It would burn out of control. And as most bring out, all of this is the sovereignty of God is keeping these things from destroying everything, because simply it's beyond control. See, then the second angel. Now it's a huge mountain, all ablaze. And all three of these are kind of based upon volcanoes and meteors. The third one, the blazing star, is definitely a meteor. The second one, the huge mountain ablaze, could be a volcano or a meteor, it doesn't matter. What we're dealing here with is ultimate conflagrations, ultimate judgments. You know, and again, we have to understand the Roman Empire. This would be bad enough for us. But the Roman Empire was built upon sea trade. You know, Rome was in the boot of Italy. Trade could not come overland from Rome. It would have been a poor, small little city if all it had was overland. Rome's wealth and power depended upon the sea. So this image was far more devastating for Rome than it is for us. One third of all the living creatures died. Now again, that's just beyond imagination. One third of the ships destroyed. There wouldn't be any civilization. It would be over. That would be it. And then the third one comes, and now it's all the inland waters. You know, As living in Chicago, right on the Great Lakes, now this is probably more powerful for me, this view, but well, Dan and I too, having been in Winnipeg, there's several years ago, Minnesota got proud of itself, put on its license plate, land of 10,000 plates, you know, we are it. Well, the next year, Manitoba put on its plates, land of 100,000 lakes, you know, Dinkville, Minnesota. But thinking about every one of these lakes, you see, being turned to poison, wormwood. Now, we get all of our drinking water from Lake Michigan. And the thought of that being turned to poison, which is what this is, again, it's unbelievable. How could anything ever recover from such a thing? You know, I look and see what SARS is doing. And I was supposed to go to Hong Kong literally about 3 weeks from now, maybe 4 weeks. Well, it's been canceled. And the people who sent me the email that say we've got to postpone it told me about the horrible conditions in Hong Kong right now with the hospitals closing because everybody's afraid to go outside. And everybody being choosy, and the restaurants closed, the hotels closed, churches canceling services. Then you look on the internet, and there have been 46 people total dead in Hong Kong. 700 cases. And it's closed down one of the most powerful cities in the world. Well, if SARS can do that to Hong Kong and Singapore, what could this do to civilization? It would just simply cease. See, that's the whole point of all these. The fourth angel, and this is not a total eclipse of the sun. The very last full total eclipse occurred about 10 years ago. Now, I remember at Trinity happened right at chapel time. I told him outside, said it's going to be about 75 years before you get another total eclipse. So we went outside, and to be honest, we would not have noticed a total eclipse if we hadn't been told. But we all had a little piece of paper, you know, we always did the whole thing and saw the total eclipse. But it just looked like, you know, a moderately hazy day is all it looked like. This is total darkness. This is not just an eclipse. This is like in Egypt, where the darkness was so total that people could not travel from place to place. That's what we have here. And again, the sun is a sign of life. So we're dealing again, you see, with unbelievable judgments. Well, that then leads to the three woes. And all of the seals, trumpets, and bowls, they break down into four and three. The first four of each seal, trumpet, bowls is judgments on earth. The last three are cosmic in scope in all of them. So look at the last three of the trumpets. They're anchored in the eagle that is crying out, woe, woe, woe. Now, New Testament scholars do a lousy job with the word woe. And we always make it into a pity party. I feel sorry for you. Well, the Old Testament oracles, the woe oracles, are not pity, they are the judgment of God has fallen upon you. And that's what the woes here mean. It's not just terror and, oh, you're so sorry. It is, this is it. Divine judgment has come, and we are at that moment. And so each of these are highlighted as the first, the second, and the third woe. Well, the first and the second woe, the fifth and sixth trumpets, deal with the demonic. These are the longest of all of the judgments. These are by far the longest judgments. And the reason is, what we have here is a philosophy of how demons function and what demons do. And God is giving them this time to prove their mettle in a very real sense. That's really, in all of it we mentioned, that it's the sovereignty of God that's in control. God gave them that last 3.5 year period. And these events are God simply allowing the demons to do what they want. So the fifth angel sounds a trumpet. And now then, an angel comes from the sky. I personally think it's a good angel, not a bad angel. That's a big debate. But anyway, he opens the abyss. Out comes this huge smoke from a furnace. And then out of the smoke comes this huge locust plague. And this imagery actually definitely fits locust plagues. Like there have been several that have been chronicled. There was one, I think it was 1880 something, where the locust plague lasted for days. They just kept coming for days. And there was one in 1910, a locust plague, that was measured. It was 4 miles thick and 100 miles long. And they figured there were several trillion locusts in that one plague. So this actually can be literal so far. But the key is this. This is a reversal of what locusts really are. because the locusts are commanded by God here not to do what they do. Locusts only eat vegetation. Locusts never hurt anybody. Now the Lord has told you cannot eat vegetation. Don't harm any of the grass of the trees. Only harm people. But now we see the other key. Only harm those people who do not have the mark of God. In other words, as in Egypt, only the Egyptians, only the earth dwellers. But what they do then, these locusts are half scorpions. Now a scorpion sting has been measured, and I looked it up. It's 40 times as strong as a wasp. Now it won't kill an adult, but it'll send them to the hospital. It will kill a baby. What these locusts do is they are given 5 months. Now 5 months is the lifespan of a locust. And 5 months is the harvest season in the Holy Land. So this is very specific. And what they are doing is they are torturing their followers for 5 months. I mean, can you imagine, you know, a dozen scorpion stings a day for 5 months? The pain would be unending. There would definitely think if SARS could do that, imagine what these locusts could do. Everything would just be at a standstill. There'd be nothing but agony for that entire time. And there would obviously be no medicine because the doctors are being stung and the nurses are being stung. In other words, pretty much life would cease. And everybody will want only to die, but they won't be able to die. See, then comes the sixth. And the sixth are the demonic horsemen. They are bound. They are demons. And they are allowed to come up, and they are 200 million strong. Now, what we need to understand about 200 million is the basic population of Rome in the first century is about 250 million. In other words, this is one demonic horseman for every man, woman, and child. Secondly, this is about 2,000 times as large as all the Roman legions put together. This is an absolutely invincible army. And they go forth, and now they give people death, and they kill one-third of mankind, 2 billion this time. And it, as everybody knows, the only reason it's only one-third is because God's in control. He won't let them kill everybody. But the basic point, though, you have to go back to the Gospels. Why do demons possess people? They don't possess people because they like bodies. They don't wish they had bodies. They possess people to torture and kill those who are made in the image of God. But Satan knows his time is short. What can he do with his frustrated anger? The answer is simple. All he can do is cause as much pain and suffering as possible for the short time he has. This absolutely proves, you see, how the demons feel about their own followers. But look at the last two verses of chapter 9. When they are given an opportunity to repent, they refuse to repent. They prefer to worship the very demons who tortured and killed them than to turn to God. See, this is proof of total depravity, as I mentioned yesterday. This is absolute proof. Now we come to the sixth trumpet leads into the next interlude, 10:1-11:13. And as you can see in this interlude, we first of all have the angel and the little scroll. Now the purpose of this is actually, and it comes right out of Ezekiel, is to tell John and the church what life is like. It's sweet in the mouth, bitter in the belly. Now what that means is, it's sweet because we know God is in control, you will vindicate, but it's bitter because there's a great amount of suffering to endure. And that, in a very real sense, is Christian life. This was not just a message about the last days. This was a message to John and his church and us and our churches as what life is really like. It is sweet because God's on our side. It is bitter because this is a sinful world. And Christians are going to be hated and persecuted. So this, in a very real sense, is simply a message. But then we come to chapter 11. There's three parts of this, actually. There's the angel little scroll, then there's the measuring of the temple. Which, again, Ezekiel. The measuring of the temple means this is God's property. But here, notice, what is measured is not just the temple, but also the worshipers. And then the outer court is not measured. It is given to the Gentiles to trample. That's the key to this whole thing. What it's really saying is, God is watching over his people. But the Gentiles have 42 months. Now, this imagery goes back to Daniel 9 and the 3.5 years, the last half of the 7th week of Daniel. But interestingly, the 7 is never mentioned, the last week. All that is ever mentioned is 3.5 years, but the 3.5 years is never mentioned. It's all symbolic. You have 42 months, you have 1260 days, and you have time times and half a time. Now, time times and half time mean time 1, times 2, half, 3.5. 1260 days is ideal 30-day months, 42 months, 3.5 years. The only place this is mentioned is chapters 10 to 13 in the whole book, because it's the period that is given to Satan to do his final work. It's the final period of history that God has allowed Satan. We're going to see that when we get to chapter 13. But the main thing here is, notice God has done it. God has given the outer court to the Gentiles. The outer court was the court of Gentiles. And so the Gentiles are being allowed by God to trample. And these are the two sides of the book and make it very difficult. Because you ask, is God the world's worst bodyguard? Here he has promised to protect his people, and his people are being stomped into the ground. We have to understand what the book is all about. God is protecting us spiritually, but not physically. It's Matthew 10. Don't be afraid of those who can merely kill the body. Be afraid of the one who can kill the soul and cast it into the enemy. God has given Satan this time, and it is a time of persecution. Also, Mark 10 is an important one there, because Mark tells, Mark, Jesus said, you know, Peter says, we've given everything up for you, what's in it for us? And Jesus says, for every father, mother, brother, sister, home you lose, there's 100, which means the church. But then he adds, along with persecution. See, Jesus vindicates us, he watches over us, he protects us, but he also allows us to be persecuted. So the protection means spiritual, but we're still going to suffer persecution. We will still be trampled. But God is watching over us, kept by the power of God, 1 Peter 1, is behind us. See, that's when we then move right into the two witnesses, so it's pulled right out of the measuring of the temple. The two witnesses, I personally believe, are two individuals who appear at the end of history. Probably the majority of commentaries think that this is entirely symbolic of the church. Well, I personally think that, again, we have a both and. These are symbolic of the church, but they are also two individuals. The reason I think that is the beast comes out of the abyss and kills them. And the beast, I believe, definitely, I have no doubt whatsoever, is the Antichrist. And that's based upon 2 Thessalonians 2 and 1 John 2, which says, we know Antichrist is coming. The man of lawlessness will appear. So the beast is the Antichrist, and that's an actual individual at the end of history. And if the beast is a person, I think the two witnesses are probably also two individuals whom God will raise up as he did the Baptist. These two witnesses are not Moses and Elijah, but they will be coming like the Baptist did in the spirit and power of Moses and Elijah. And the miracles that they do are the miracles that Elijah and Moses did. And the period here, what this really pictures is that as this period is going on, and this is another era of Left Behind series, by the way, the saints are engaging in bold witness. Or I think Left Behind is very wrong, is it pictures this tribulation, what do they call it, tribulation force. They're doing Tom Clancy type underground, you know, revolutionary activity against the Antichrist. They're stealing his planes. They're tricking him here and there. That's not going to happen. The one thing that Tim LaHaye somehow always missed is when we look at Revelation 13:10, which calls the saints to passivity. We're not going to be fighting back against the Antichrist. We're also not going to be hiding in caves and forests like the survivalists have said, like it's Y2K, everybody buying all this rice and all this stuff and guns and planning to hide and the building homes and in the middle of forests and so on. Not going to happen. The saints are going to be engaged in bold witness throughout the whole period. So I think that's what chapter 11 is telling us. Then at the end of that, we see the two witnesses caught up. This could be the rapture. Personally, I think it may well be, But I see it cyclically. So I see this event of verse 11 and 12 occurring at chapter 19 when Christ returns by my cyclical view. This is the heart of the mid-tribulation position. And everything depends on whether you take the seals, trumpets, and bowls as consecutive sequence or as cycles. You have to decide that for yourself. You know, all I can tell you is, for me, it's more likely that these are cycles, that all three of them end at the return of Christ at the end of time. I think that makes most sense. Especially because we now then come to the seventh trumpet. And the seventh trumpet, look what it says. The kingdom of this world has already become the kingdom of our Lord. The seventh trumpet is after Christ's return, looking back on it. And it's celebrating the victory and the joy of Christ. That's what the seventh trumpet is all about. It's the beginning of eternity. Now we turn to the greatest and the longest of all the interludes. The third interlude is chapters 12 to 14. And I've got to watch my watch. It's going to be hard to get through all this. I'm taking too long because to me it's just too much good stuff. Chapter 12 and 13 can best be understood by seeing it as, in a sense, the basic story is verses 1 to 6. It's the woman, the dragon, and the child. There's been so much written about it. I think it's a fabulous passage. Look at the woman. I think the woman, firstly, is the whole people of God. That's another thing. I think it's Israel in this immediate context, bringing forth the Messiah. But it's Israel then that becomes the church, as then the woman flees in the desert to the place prepared for her. And all this is going to be expanded over the next two chapters. So I think it's the whole people of God, Israel in the church. But the marvelous thing is, we see this woman. She's a great and wondrous sign. She has the sun for her clothes, the moon for her feet, and the stars on her head. Now look at the dragon in the next verse. The woman's a great wonder sign, the dragon's just another sign. What is really happening here is it is emphasizing the greatness of the people of God over against the dragon, who in a sense is a nothing. All he is a dragon who hates. But all the wonder and all the majesty is with the woman, the people of God. It's just a very beautiful picture here. But the main thing is how the dragon tries to destroy the work of God. The Messiah is about to come. The dragon wants to devour him. And then the story skips the life of Christ and goes straight to the ascension. What it really means to you is everything Satan tries to do, God frustrates. And so he's filled with wrath. And he goes after the woman, who now flees to the desert, to the place prepared for her. And notice, she is taken care of for that 1260 days, 42 months, 3.5 year period. And again, it goes right back to the measuring of the temple and to the sealing of the saints. It is saying, God is watching over his people. As they are being hounded and persecuted and martyred, God is watching over them. And he is taking care of them. But that doesn't mean they're going to escape persecution. Now the rest of it actually expands. The basic story is 1 to 6. 7 to 11 expands verse 4. Verse 4 is the war in heaven. The tail swept a third of the stars. That is now expanded in verses 7 and 9 with the war in heaven. And notice again, it's not Satan versus God. There's no dualistic. This isn't dualism. The one who's parallel with Satan is Michael. And Michael is more than a match. He defeats Satan utterly. God doesn't need to go after Satan himself. Satan is not a god. Satan, who knows, may have been an archangel. I think that's the closest we can get. But Michael is the more powerful one, because they throw Satan and he sweeps a third of the stars, verse 4. Those are the followers, the fallen angels who've gone after him. So what it does tell us is Satan's hordes, the demons, are half as big as the angels. One third of all the angels God created. The main thing here is, though, they lost and they were hurled to earth. Then we see the celebration and the beauty of 10 to 12, one of the great passages. Because Satan accuses us day and night, but we've already defeated him. Verse 11, key verse. We defeated him because of two things, the blood of the Lamb, and secondly, we did not love our lives so much as the strength of death, which is our witness. It's bold witness in the face of death. Because you can't see, that's a model for us. and for John's church, and it will characterize the church at the end of history. Therefore, all Satan has left is wrath. That's where verse 12 is the key verse for much of the Bible. He's gone down to earth filled with wrath. He knows the time is short. Now then, we come to the rest of it. 13 to 17 expands verse 6. The woman fleeing to the desert, and the dragon pursuing her and trying to destroy her. But she's given, notice verse 14, two wings like a great eagle, and she flies to the place prepared. See, that's verse 6. And then the dragon tries to destroy her, spews forth this flood. And really, the flood, almost everybody agrees, is two things. It's a flood of persecution and a flood of temptation. And the overcoming theme of the book of Revelation is overcoming this flood that the dragon spews our way. And Christians need to understand that. Now, chapter 13, notice it says, he's even more angry, verse 17, he now goes to make war against the rest of her offspring. That's chapter 13. Chapter 13 tells how the dragon wages his war. It's intimately tied to chapter 12. And he makes war against the offspring through the other two beasts. And now we have the false trinity. The dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. Now that language comes from chapter 16, 13. But the two beasts here are those. The beast from the sea is the first one. The beast from the land is the second one. And the beast from the land is the false prophet. What the beast from the land actually becomes is the high priest of the cult to worship the Antichrist and the dragon. The first beast is the Antichrist. And actually, the language is so close. This is really Steven Spielberg at his best. Notice the dragon is standing on the shore of the sea, and the beast emerges just as he would in a movie. Out of the sea, and sea, by the way, is a symbol of evil in the book of Revelation. The sea stands for evil. And so he's coming out of his evil, and you see him one at a time, his horns, then his head, then his body. But he looks just like the dragon. He has seven heads and 10 horns, except it's reversed. The dragon has seven heads and 10 horns with the crowns on his heads. Look here, the beast has seven horns and 10 horns and seven heads and the crowns on his horns. What that means is the dragon is the king of the evil empire. The crowns on his head. The beast is the military general. Horns were a sign of military prowess. So the crowns on the horns means he is the one who conducts the war on behalf of the dragon. See, and that's how he's operating. Then we see what he does. And in chapter 13, basically he does about three or four different things. First, he dies and then comes back to life. Mortal wound is healed. And this is where we get what I'm going to talk about is the futility of Satan. All that the dragon and the beast are doing is copying what God has already done. The great imitation. Everything they do merely imitates. The mortal wound that's healed is an imitation of the death and resurrection of Christ. But the difference is, when Christ rose from the dead, only a few were converted. When the beast does it, when he counterfeits that miracle, a whole world flocks after him. And it ends in universal worship. And again, it's because of total depravity. And the key is, first of all, look at verses 5 to 8. This is the verb was given. That means it's a divine passive. God gave the beast permission to do four things. Verse 5, to blaspheme. Verse 5b, to have authority. Verse 7, to make war against the saints. And then verse 8, to cause the whole world to worship. Every one of them is was given, which means the Antichrist can't do anything without God's permission and authorization. God is allowing him to do these things. See, that's the whole point. He isn't in control. God is. And in a sense, God is now proving the power of total depravity and the necessity of final judgment. It's a court of law that's being established. Evidence is being gathered. And chapter 13 is part of that evidence. See, and then comes the beast from the earth, and he is the high priest. Another Arab left behind, by the way. But really, I just think it's crazy. The Antichrist Carpathia has nothing but contempt for the high priest, Fortunato. And he makes fun of him and mocks him all the time. That's not going to happen. this is the high priest, and this is a member of the false trinity. They're going to work in concert. His job is to get the whole world to worship the beast and the dragon. He does it by erecting a huge statue. And by the way, in Ephesus, about in the 80s, a 25-foot statue had been erected to Domitian. It really fits what actually had happened in the province of Asia at this time. But the difference is, now he's going to give life to this. And this idol is going to speak. And what this idol is going to say is that the whole world must worship or die. That's where they established then the mark of the beast. And there's so many ways we can see this happening. Personally, if it were to happen soon, I see it very easily as a microchip that would be embedded. And what they would say is there's now no longer going to be any need for money, for currency, and there will never again be any stealing. Because everybody will walk in the buildings and walk out, and the computers know exactly what they've done. And you won't need money, but then the whole point is that it's setting it up. The only people who can get this chip, which is going to do this, are people who are going to worship the beast. But you know, that would happen very easily. The technology is virtually there now. The main thing is, behind it is that economic pressure and the death penalty, and then followed by 666. And let me just take a minute on 666. 666 has been so misused down through history. You know, it's been everybody. I remember there's a story of a famous scholar at a major international conference who basically gave a paper and he said, the only thing I'm sure of is 666 is not me. Then he had one of his genius friends go back to his room that night and discover that an ancient Coptic, this guy's name added up to 666. An ancient Coptic was the very first translation of the Bible, by the way. So the whole thing is, though, that is probably something like that. This is based on gematria. And gematria means that every letter is also a number. See, until the Arabs, there were never separate symbols for numbers. All peoples down through history, their numbers have been letters of the alphabet. Each one of us had a number. Therefore, every name we see had a numerical value as well. And they would add them up to do things. I think that's exactly what this means. And the other thing is, it's not something today. All these foolish people are looking for 666 in the credit card or in Microsoft or somebody's name in Kissinger or the craziest thing that I received, Ronald Wilson Reagan. I really did receive a brochure on that. Because he has three names, each with six letters. That is certainly a quite ignorant person. 666 had its meaning in the first century. Now, we can't know for sure, and even there have been dozens, but there is one that is moderately close. Nero Caesar, in one spelling in Aramaic, which was used in the first century, added up to 666. What makes it possible is that in many manuscripts, there's an alternate number, 621. Nero Caesar in Latin adds up to 621. Now, that doesn't prove that this is it, but it's the only thing that is close. And it does fit, because what is being said here is the Antichrist will be the final Nero. Not that Nero is going to come back from the dead and be Antichrist. There's no way anybody ever thought that, but rather that Nero was the symbol. In the same way that the Empire of the Beast will be the final unholy Roman Empire, the Antichrist will be the final Nero, in a sense. Now again, that doesn't prove that that's it, but at least it's a good approximation. Chapter 14. Chapter 14 has three sections. And the first one is deliberately placed here into contrast with the surrounding. Because we see the same 144,000 who were sealed, the people of God, now standing on Mount Zion. I think this is probably an earthly scene. And they are worshiping God, and they're singing this final song of deliverance. And they're filled with joy. And they have been triumphant. They have overcome temptation and sin. This then is contrast to the three angels who followed. The first angel is giving the final offer of salvation again. We've already mentioned that yesterday. Offering, you know, the eternal gospel. Fear God, give Him glory, the hour of His judgment is come. One final chance, which is these judgments that are coming down. But now the second angel is given to those who reject the first angel. Second angel, fall in Babylon the Great, which will be expanded in chapter 18, as we'll see in a few minutes. The third angel, then, is giving this incredible picture of judgment to come. And the judgment to come is unbelievable. And the eternality of it is so stressed. You know, they have tormented with burning sulfur in the presence of the holy angels, verse 10. The smoke of the torment rising forever and ever, verse 11. A horrible picture of those who have rejected God's overtures and who stand guilty and now will have eternal punishment. But look how it actually ends. It ends on a note of warning. This calls for patient endurance, verse 12, in the part of the saints. Blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. So it's a call to perseverance. It's warning the saints to remain faithful or else, in a sense. Especially in the seven letters, those cult members you see are being warned of their eternal danger that's waiting them. This is very strong. This then, final part, is the harvest. And there's two harvests. There's a grain harvest and a grape harvest. But again, the basic picture is the unbelievable picture of eternal punishment. But this is the famous passage. Verse 20, you know, you have the wine press of the wrath of God, and the blood flowing as high as a horse's dry foal. To make it more graphic, I've had some of these things figured out scientifically. And I had one person who, I just said it in Sunday school class, I'm teaching it in my home church, teaching Revelation to the whole year, one of my colleagues and I. And I just said, I wish that I would have had somebody figure this out. How many people would have to die? The key is, 1600 stadia is 184 miles. That's the exact length of Palestine. Therefore, what's being pictured is all of Palestine covered with blood, about 5 feet deep for a horse's bridle. And so a guy from my class did that on the basis of about, you know, I think it's 5.5 quarts of blood that the average human person has. Comes out to 3,282,000,000 dead to do this. To have that much blood. Now, of course, it's really meant to be a graphic picture, but that helps us to make it even more graphic in terms of what this would be. And I think it is simple. I don't think it's just going to happen exactly this way. It's a symbol. But it's a powerful symbol, and we're supposed to feel it. There's been no war like it in terms of, you know, all wars have the ground flooded with blood for the dead, especially in the ancient world where they fought with swords and so on. And the ground was covered with blood. Civil War is another. It's horrible just the thought of, you know, Gettysburg and Shiloh. Shiloh is close to here, isn't it? Horrible to think of that many people. But that's what this is picturing. The worst industry is what this is picturing. See, that then leads to the seven bowls, chapters 15 and 16. Chapter 15 is the same kind of introduction with the actions in heaven. With the song of Moses is being sung, to the wondrous deeds of God who has delivered his people. And notice the key. Just and true are your ways. Right there in verse 3. Who will not fear you, O Lord, and bring you glory? So chapter 15 is worshiping God for his wondrous deeds that are going to deliver his people. Chapter 16 then, the final judgments fall out. And you have the seven bowls. And the seven bowls, again, follow the same order. But now these are the final bowls, the whole earth. And one at a time, the earth, every single non-Christian is covered with boils. Again, that would stop everything in its tracks. I remember I had my first boil about 2 years ago. And I had to walk very carefully. It was on my thigh. And it hurt a lot if, you know, your slacks rubbed against it. Imagine being covered by boils. You couldn't walk, you couldn't stand, you couldn't lay down, you couldn't sit, you couldn't do anything. And so really, again, it's picturing pretty much everything falls. Nothing but pain. Then, now the next two, the oceans and the waters, now everything is covered with blood. And all the ships, all the fish die. And here we see this basic thing stated again. See, the heart of the theme of justice. You're just in these judgments, you who are and who were. They shed the blood of the saints and prophets. You've given them blood to drink as they deserve. So the whole thing is justice of God. Lex talionis. They have done it, and they have received the results of what they've done. This is just. This then leads to the final bowls. And in the final bowls, we move to Armageddon. And First of all, the sixth bowl, the Euphrates is dried up. The kings of the east come forth. Now, the kings of the east were the Parthians, who the Romans were afraid of. But now, the kings of the east ride across and join the Romans and join the coalition against the God of his people. And Armageddon is ready. But look right in the middle, we have verse 15, where Jesus suddenly stops and speaks and dictates to John. And all of a sudden, Jesus is shining through John's description, and he says, "Behold, I am coming like a thief. Blessed is the one who stays awake, keeps his clothes with him." Now, these are two things. Stays awake is Sardis. Keeping his clothes, shameful nakedness, is Laodicea, the two churches that had nothing good to say about them. And what Christ is doing is he's warning those people and all of us like them that we'd better watch out because this might be our future life. See, that's the whole point. See, and then comes the seventh. Everything is done. Eternity is started. Now we come to the conclusion. I'm going to go through quickly. The last chapter, 17 to 22. First of all, the great prostitute is destroyed in chapter 17. And she is the empire of the beast. Now in chapter 17 and 18, all of the judgments are economic. And when you look at it, they are very powerful. The woman is judged because, look at verses 4 and 5. Dresses in purple and scarlet, holy kings to death, glittering with gold, stones and pearls, a gold cup in her hand. So she is judged, and we also see the key symbols interpreted, like the seven heads you have interpreted. And the seven heads deal with Roman emperors. The Antichrist, the final one, the unholy emperor. But the whole point has to do with destruction. Chapter 18 is Babylon the Great, another picture of the empire. And Babylon the Great is judged for the same thing. In the middle of it, 9 to 19, are three laments. Every one of them end with, "Woe, woe, great city, in 1 hour your doom is come." The instantaneous destruction by God. But, especially with the merchants of the earth, we don't have time to do it now, I'll just challenge you. We have a list of the wealth and the luxury of Rome in verses 12 to 14. What I challenge you to do sometime is read this list and ask, how many of these do I have in my home? We have more wealth than even Rome had ever imagined. And the question is God judging us because wealth has become our idol? Just like it did Rome. Chapter 18 is devastating. Then 19 to 22. Took too long getting through this. 19 is the return of Christ. It begins with a hallelujah of choruses. The only hallelujah in the New Testament is chapter 19. What is being praised is God destroying the nations. Christ is now coming, but there's a beautiful picture, an ABA picture. It begins with the wedding supper of the Lamb in 9 and 10. Then Christ comes in judgment, and then you have the great supper of God in 17 to 21. Now let me give you a sermon title for this section, because it's framed, the return of Christ is framed by the two great suppers. The sermon title is, "Do you want to be the eater or the eaten?" This is a great evangelistic sermon. And it's deliberately. All humanity will either partake of God's incredible messianic banquet or be the banquet for the carrion birds after being destroyed by Christ. See, it's a great passage on choose you this day whom you will serve, because that determines whether you will be served as food for the birds. Chapter 20, the millennium. There are so many aspects of this. Let me just briefly give, looking at my watch, amillennial and premillennial. The primary argument for the amillennial is that the binding of Satan is binding Satan to keep him from stopping the gospel going forward. And for the amillennialist, when it says they came to life, it's talking about the intermediate state. Augustine said it, talks about conversion. Most today, B.L. Hokama, intermediate state. The primary argument of the amillennial is actually in verses 7 to 10, where it says that Satan came back and he gathered for war. That's the exact words of chapter 16, where they gathered the nations for war, the exact Greek words. So the argument of the amillennial is there's only one battle, and Armageddon is 27 to 10 and chapter 19. That's the primary argument. Now, Most of us say, well, that's ridiculous. Well, actually, not truly. Again, half the believers in history have been amillennialists and half premillennialists, that's especially today in our world. They're both Bible views. I personally cannot accept that because, especially 21 to 3, Satan is so bound, and it's bound to keep him from deceiving the world. In the book of Revelation, deceiving the world is what he does, and he has not stopped from deceiving the world. I think you can't stop the gospel. That's not enough for what it means here. I think this is a literal reign of Christ on earth. Satan is not there. And first, let me give, there's several reasons for the millennium why God would do it. One would certainly be his glory, and in a sense, the manifestation of the prophecies of the Old and New Testaments. The second one is the vindication of the saints, which would be one of the major reasons in the book of Revelation. This is the fulfillment. The saints have seen their persecutors destroyed. Now they themselves have been so beaten down, reign with Christ for 1,000 years. But that in itself is also not enough because 22:66 says we'll reign with Christ for eternity. I think there's another one, and I think it's the finalization of total depravity and the theodicy of the Lord. That is, the nations are still somehow around, because in verses 7 to 10, you'll see that he goes out and he deceives the nations again in verse 8. Well, where do these nations come from? I don't think they're the children of the saints who don't accept Christ. That's their normal view. I think, personally, that the Battle of Armageddon destroyed the armies, but not all the other peoples who weren't part of the armies. And the nations go through the millennial reign. Those who did not die at Armageddon. And they then, who have experienced one lifetime with Satan, have 14 lifetimes with Christ. And then Satan comes back, and in a millisecond, they fly after him. It's the final proof of total depravity. And it leads right into, I think, the Great White Throne Judgment that absolutely necessitates eternal punishment. To the universalists who say a God of love who is omnipotent will in a billion years bring Hitler to repentance, they don't understand sin. In a billion years, Hitler would hate God more than he did the day he died. And the only option for God is eternal punishment because sin has become an eternal force. See, I think that's why. That then leads us then to the new Jerusalem, the new heaven, new earth. Personally, I think that what is happening here is heaven and earth are now being amalgamated into one whole reality. That's the way I see it. New heaven, new earth means they're now one entity. And we're not going to be in eternity with walking earth and going to heaven if we wish. Again, that's very debated, and we'll have to wait and see. God simply doesn't tell us. The main thing, though, is this is the culmination of it all. Just like chapter 12, 21:1-6 is the basic picture. The basic picture. We see then that heaven, the new heaven, new earth coming down. We see what it means in fulfillment, culmination, everything the Old Testament pointed to. All of the covenants, Shema. God is now with us, and we are his people. He is our God, and we walk with him. Then this is expanded, just like 12:1-6 was expanded. This is expanded in two pictures. 21:9-27, the rest of chapter 21, expands that picture by showing that the new heaven and new earth is the final Holy of Holies. The city is a perfect cube, 1,500 miles long, wide, and high, and it's covered with gold, like the Holy of Holies. Heaven really is going to be, we are going to live for eternity in the Holy of Holies, in the very presence of God, the Shekinah glory. The gold is transparent because it has no glory of its own. The true Shekinah glory of God radiates through the golden city. And all of the description of it is to show, and it's built on chapter 4, the throne room. It's the glory and the majesty, but now we share the glory and the majesty of God. Then 22:1-5 goes to the next level and pictures eternity as the final Eden. What the Garden of Eden would have become if Adam and Eve hadn't sinned is what we will have. And the picture is incredible. I especially love this for Chicago. It says, down the middle of the great street of the city comes this incredible road. Now, whenever I go to Chicago from Trinity, we're on the north side, and the interstate there is called the Edens. And it's always under construction. It's always filled with potholes. And it's a lousy road. And there's always trash all over. So in Chicago, I could say, we will finally have the true Great Eden. And there won't be trash. There won't be potholes. And in between is going to be the river, the water of life, but the tree of life on both the 12 crops of fruit, which just expands everything, you know, that comes out of the Garden of Eden in Genesis 3. This is what it would have become. And this is what it would be for eternity. And again, it's the culmination of all the hopes, all the dreams, all the desires. Let me just now take the last couple of minutes. Actually, we started late, so I'm still at about an hour, but I will go a little beyond it. Let me do that. And since I've done the theology, I've taken extra time on structure. So let me just go through the theology quickly. Everything here I've said, the primary theme in Revelation is the sovereignty of God, the divine names. You know, the Alpha and the Omega, which means sovereign over history. God is absolutely sovereign. And that's the whole purpose in the book of Revelation. I've already talked about the was given, the determinism. You know, even Satan has to ask God for permission. Everything the Antichrist does so because it was given. God authorized it to do it. See, that then leads to the utility of Satan, which we've already talked about. He's already lost. He knows it. The battle was won at the cross. All he can do is imitate what God has done, which he does in all kinds of ways, the false trinity, you know, in a sense, the counterfeit resurrection, and all the miracles that the second beast does, simply repeat the miracles of Christ and the two witnesses. So there's nothing Satan can do. He is not a powerful being. But the key is deception, the greatest con man who ever lived. Person of Christ. Oneness with God, we saw that so clearly, all the way through. Actually, Alpha and Omega, let me use that for a minute. Alpha and Omega appears four times in the book, twice at the beginning, twice at the end. At the beginning, God is Alpha and Omega in verse 7, then Jesus is Alpha and Omega later in the first chapter. And in chapter 22, God is Alpha and Omega, and then Jesus is Alpha and Omega. See, and in 22:1, it's God and the Lamb on the throne. Therefore, the main theme is Jesus is one with God. He is God himself. He's also the slain lamb. He's also the judge, as we've already seen. The saints. The saints are a major focus. In a sense, you can think that the two main themes of the book of Revelation, the vertical theme is the sovereignty of God. The horizontal theme is the perseverance of the saints. It calls upon us to remain faithful. Yes, we will be martyred, but really, the meaning of martyr comes out of the book of Revelation. It really wasn't used that way until about 200 years later, about the 3rd century. They began to use the martus for witness, for martyr. But it came out of the book of Revelation because witnessing is martyrdom. And martyrdom is witnessing. And as I mentioned yesterday, I think I did with you, in terms of death, we need to see this incredible message about what death means. Because in 13:7, the Antichrist is given authority to make war against the saints and conquer them, which means to kill them. But in 12:11 is the great irony that whenever Satan takes our life, we have already defeated him. And I'm not sure if I said it in the second one, I know I said it in the first one, but think about it this way. Every martyrdom is another nail in Satan's coffin. Whenever Satan takes the life of one of God's people, another nail goes in his coffin. And Satan participates in that, and that's another thing. Martyrdom is a replication of the death of Jesus. Because Satan participated in his own defeat when he led Christ to the cross. But he had no choice. He knew he was going to do it, I believe. But what else can he do? He at least could cause Christ unbelievable suffering. He knew it was a lot. And the same with us. He knows that we will defeat him as he leads us to our death, but he still gets the joy of doing it. In a sense, you know, it's Satan's sadistic nature, but it's all he has in his frustrated anger. But it's our victory. See, and that then leads to the end. I mentioned the scroll is God's plan for bringing this world to him. And in all of it, we see here the absolute defense, the theodicy of eternal punishment. God is sovereign. We have already won. The book of Revelation gives us our marching orders. That we are part of the Church of the Last Days. And in that, we have the privilege of serving God in a difficult world with a difficult life. But in that, we are not only vindicated, we share the glory of Christ. And we have this incredible future of eternity that we know. All right, let's close with prayer. Thank you, Lord, for this book, for the joy of looking at it briefly, for the joy of discovery that we'll have for the rest of our lives as we study it, as we see you use it in our ministries. Thank you, Lord, that you've given us these promises, but help us to realize the warnings as well, and especially to address those Christians who are playing games with you, who are living half-Christian lives, are in the very real danger of this book. And so we just pray that you'll help us to take this back to our churches. May we be transforming presences, as we ask it in your name. Amen. Thank you for coming.
Well, it's good he goes on. Hey.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. All right. Very good job. Okay, am I quite sure you're ready for this? Sure, I'm quite ready for this. Okay. Okay. It's the witch doctor people. It looks like the village people. I don't know. Okay, we have Neil, Charlie, Ted, McCarty.